From VinePair's New York City headquarters, I'm Joanna Sciarrino.
And in Seattle, Washington, I'm Zach Jabal.
And this is the VinePair podcast. Zach, it's Monday. We're back.
We're back.
How's your weekend? What have you been drinking?
You know, it was a relatively chill weekend. Just kind of hanging around the homestead, such as it is. Kind of trying to keep the kids from, you know, destroying the house when it's rainy out. It's always fun. But yeah, I had a couple of nice things, but stand out for me probably was a bottle of Pinot Noir from the Eyrie Vineyards, one of the OG producers in the Willamette Valley. They're just their estate Pinot Noir. Not necessarily something that I always, well, we don't gravitate towards it at home a whole lot because Caitlin is not a huge Pinot Noir fan, although she's a bigger fan of Oregon Pinot Noir than some others, but kind of just decided I was going to open it, and you know, we went along for the ride. So that was pretty tasty and a fun bottle, and had a couple of martinis over the weekend too that I made, because after we talk about a drink, sometimes I'm in the mood for it, and yet I wasn't quite ready for a margarita.
No margs yet.
Despite its, well, you know, it's hard when it's like 51 degrees and pouring down rain to feel too much like making a margarita, for me personally at least. I need like one ray of sunshine minimum, I think.
Sure.
So so I was like, well, we did talk about the martini, so I'm gonna stir up one of those. And you know, the weekends for me are like prime martini time, because I can drink one and then enjoy what it does to me when the kids are asleep.
Sure.
Which I mean, puts me to sleep also.
Yeah.
Nothing more exciting than that. How about you, Joanna?
Yeah, the editorial team and I were fortunate to have the folks from Andre Brunel in, and we did a very special vertical tasting with them of their Chantenouf du Pape, and had a 1985 bottling that was really special. I think that's one of the oldest wines I've had, certainly older than me.
Yes. Certainly.
But also had the 2000, 2005, 2010, and the 2020 vintages. So that was really exciting and really special. The highlight of the week for me, definitely.
Fantastic. That sounds like a highlight of many weeks, honestly.
Yeah, I mean, okay, it was like, it was midday, so that was a little tough. It was like 2 o'clock.
Yeah, that's true.
And then also with those types of tastings, you don't, you know, we're spitting a lot of the wine, which is always such a shame. But, you know, you got to do it for the job, right?
I don't know. I actually
You
love
don't have to
spinning.
Do it for the job, but I do.
I do. Well, I have and I do at times. I this might be a controversial take. I love tasting and spitting. Like, it's one of my favorite things to do.
But don't you feel like, I feel like it changes how I perceive a wine when I spit it versus when I swallow it.
It doesn't change it as much as if I how I perceive the future wines if I'm swallowing all the ones before it. Like, to me, the whole point, yes, if I'm having one wine or two wines, yes, of course, I will drink the wine. But if I'm intending to get something out of a tasting besides just a buzz, it's critical to me. And I don't I don't think anyone thinks you can't let a single drop, you know, all the way down your throat. Like, you just, you got to spit out most of it, at least in my experience. And
yeah,
it's a different tasting experience. It's not complete if you don't kind of drink it a little bit. But I don't know. I think some people see tasting and spitting as somehow like disappointing or like, oh, what a letdown. And yeah, look, I mean, maybe with that 85, would I have felt compelled to drink all of it I was given? Maybe, you know, special wine, special treatment. But in general, no, I really love the whole kind of, I guess it's a ritual in a way, or the whole kind of the mechanics of. I love the whole kind of practice, I suppose, of tasting and spinning. It's one of the skills that you have to develop when you do this professionally, and I'm proud of it, I guess.
Yeah. All right. That's a take.
There you go.
Yeah.
Come at me, people who don't like to spit wine. Sorry.
So today we have a very special guest, one of my favorite special guests joining us.
I too.
To discuss
on location.
On location, yes. To discuss.
I feel like, Dave, we got to start by, what have you been drinking?
Oh, okay. All right. Special guest is Dave Infante.
Yes.
It's me. I'm back. Thank you so much for having me, guys.
And where are you, Dave? Where are you?
Zach and Joanne, I'm joining from fabulous Las Vegas out here in the desert. I have been out here all week, trying to stay hydrated, trying to stay moisturized, trying to stay in my lane. I'm out here covering the Craft Brewers Conference 2024. And, you know, I'm just so – every time I come on the Vine Pair podcast, I'm honored to be here, of course, as always. But every time I come on, I'm just – I feel like I'm so outclassed by you two. You're talking about techniques for spitting wine at high-end tastings. Meanwhile, like, my technique is to drink it as fast as possible and hope that no one asks me questions about the varietal or the vintage before they move on to more interesting patrons in the tap or in the tasting room. So
yeah.
I think we come from different perspectives, but I suppose that's what makes the Vine Pair podcast great.
We're well-rounded.
Any exciting gambling anecdotes you want to relay to us?
No gambling. I played it very close to the vest this time. I was too busy buttonholing America's brewers for their hottest takes on overrated hop varietals and the secondhand equipment market and all sorts of reporting that folks will have found in, I guess, my latest hop take column, which we published on Friday. And we'll see, you know, you'll see more of it as I sort of work through the stories. But no, I didn't. I put no chips on black or red. No hands of blackjack were played. And, you know, I'm just out here trying to get a sense, get my head around what's going on in the American craft brewing business. And I drank a lot of Riesdorf Kolsch at Silver Stamp.
Nice.
That's my update on the drinking front. Yeah.
Yeah. So Dave, you mentioned your column from this past week, and that's why we wanted to have you on to talk about your takeaways from the conference and some of our thoughts. Right, Zach?
Well, let me ask a question first, Dave, and then maybe this will help frame our conversation a touch. So I think one of the most interesting things that I took away from your coverage, both in your hop take column, some of what you put on social media, et cetera, was a sort of very interesting, you might call it a cognitive dissonance for craft brewing. You might call it sort of attempts to see the glasses both half empty and half full. I don't know, however you want to put it, but that there was a surprising amount of optimism and sort of, you know, enthusiasm, but yet a kind of creeping sense that, like, well, you know, beer as a category is shrinking. Craft beer is maybe not shrinking, but it's certainly not growing anything like the growth it had been experiencing in the last, you know, 15 years or so. And even maybe more interestingly, and I know Joanna wants to get into this, some of the stalwart categories within craft beer are maybe not quite so stalwarty. I don't know, whatever word you want to put in there. So, you know, Dave, first and foremost, what was the kind of the mood, the zeitgeist, the sort of general vibes for craft beer at the conference?
I think this is a great place to start. I mean, the vibe check, such as it was, is that despite craft beer as a category or as a segment, whatever you want to call it, as an industry, being down about 1% in volume last year and up only 3% in dollars, you know, despite some price hiking and you know, sort of inflation there, those are not good top line stats for the aggregate industry. But I mean, the attitude that I encountered again and again amongst rank and file brewers, like the members of the Brewers Association, which puts on the Craft Brewers Conference every year and has since 95, I want to say, a while, long time ago.
Yeah, wow.
You know, the vibe was, the attitude was very upbeat for the most part. In fact, surprisingly upbeat, even to the brewers themselves. I spoke to one brewer who was from Southern California. His particular brewery had only been operating for about a year and a half, and this was his first CBC, as the conference is called. And he that's exactly what he said to me. Is, man, I expected more doom and gloom, honestly. And I told him, yeah, man, me too. I was kind of on the plane, you know, on the way out here to Vegas, bracing for what I thought would be a pretty sobering experience. I had texted some, you know, friends who work in the industry or who had worked in the beer industry in years past, and was like, what do you think I'll encounter out there? And pretty uniformly, folks that I talked to leading up to the conference were of one mind, which is that, yeah, I'm kind of not looking forward to going, not because it's not a good time to see folks in the industry, but because I think it's, you know, we're going to hear some not great things, and it's there's no clear path forward for the business. That was not the vibe on the trade show floor. Things were felt as buzzy as ever. You know, the events were well attended. I would say like there were fewer, you know, the vital like after party index, right? Like this unofficial sort of reading on how the industry is doing based on like how opulent and how many of the parties there are following each of the days. I think the after party index, you know, was probably didn't post its record reading. I think there were certainly fewer sort of like trade parties afterwards than there have been in more boom times. So you could kind of feel it a little bit there. It was definitely not the sort of thing where big suppliers or big vendors were throwing thousands and thousands of dollars around like they have in years past on, you know, parties just to kind of get people out and talking with their reps. But for the most part, throughout 3 days that I was in the Venetian Expo Center, which is where it took place, the attitude was remarkably upbeat given the circumstances.
Dave, this is your first time going, right?
This is my second time going. I was in Nashville last year.
Okay. How does it compare then to last year, like attendance wise and then vibe wise?
Yeah, so attendance was definitely down this year. Okay. I think it was down moderately. The official estimate that I got from the Brewers Association on Wednesday afternoon, as I was sort of going through my notes, I checked in with their PR person, and they had a figure of about 9,500 attendees this year. Which is honestly still a pretty big conference, but compared to years past, the estimate from Nashville last year, I checked back in my notes and then in my coverage from the time, the estimate was about 12,000 in Nashville. So a significant drop off. I mean, I think it's not, you know, not a coincidence that another year into craft beer's sort of doldrums period or malaise or, you know, plateau or whatever you want to call it. And with the conference taking place in one of the most expensive destination cities in the country, in Las Vegas, I think there's probably, you know, some drop off there to be expected that you can kind of explain away. But I think even in an apples to apples sense, you know, to the extent that you can make a like to like comparison, I would say that there's, you know, that attendance figure does demonstrate a little bit of a softening in, you know, in the overall market. Maybe brewers are a little bit less willing to spend, to travel people to the show. You know, I don't think I've been a critic of the Brewers Association in the past, but I really don't get the sense that this is a referendum on like the organization's programming or its ability to speak for its constituents. That's not the sense I got. Yeah. And that wasn't really something I was hearing from members. I think it's probably just things are a little softer than usual, and some folks sort of scaled back on their travel plans because of that.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But in terms of like the vibe at Nashville, I mean, versus Vegas this year, Nashville was, I think there was a lot more sort of feeling out like what is the new normal, quote unquote, right? That took place in like April 2023, so just about a year ago.
Post-COVID.
Exactly. This was, okay, this is the first normal year, you know, like, we'll see what's going to happen, right? And what went out and happened is basically, you know, a whole lot of nothing. The slow decline of the craft beer segment continued. I mean, it's limited, and there's certainly growth within that segment, but, you know, zoom out and, like I said, about 1% down according to volume sales statistics from Bart Watson, the chief economist of the Brewers Association. And I think everyone in Nashville was hopeful that you would see bounce back on draft, that you would see maybe some shoring up in, you know, in the category or in the segment's most popular styles that had started to soften. And that hasn't happened. I mean, I think it's clear that whatever the new normal that folks were hoping for in Nashville looked like, what's come to pass is more of the same and more of that same post-pandemic sort of take the growth where you can get it and hang tight and hope for better days type outlook. That's not transient anymore in the craft brewing industry. That's what the craft brewing industry is during this period.
Yeah.
I want to ask a question, Dave, about your sense. And again, it's sort of a more of a vibesy thing, although perhaps there's some data here to back this up. But was your sense from the attendees, from some of the people you spoke to, that the, whether you want to call it, I think you said, you know, malaise, doldrums, plateau, that craft beer's struggles are just about the larger beer category's struggles, i.e. not intrinsic to craft beer? Or do people feel like they in some way are moving not in lockstep with the broader beer market?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I think there is data to share here, but as you guys know from reporting on the industry, there's just so many ways that the, you know, sales figures can be sliced to tell stories one way or the other. I mean, I think Bart Watson, who I mentioned just a moment ago, chief economist for the Brewers Association, I've been, you know, interviewing him and reporting on his work for about a decade. I've always found him to be a very straight shooter. And the point that he, you know, made is that, yes, craft is down 1%. Overall beer is down about 5% volume in the same period. And then, and this is crucial, and this was his point, is like, well, gosh, like a lot of people are saying we're losing out to spirits, and it's possible, you know, certainly in some instances that spirits are taking from beer. But we also know that BevAlc shipments overall were down substantially in 2023. So that's units of ethyl alcohol sold across the country. So his point was like, craft is down, and that's scary for the members, because this is ultimately, that's who he serves, right? The craft brewers. Beer is also down, and it's not, you know, that's something to be even a little bit more scared about, because as much as there are internal differences within the category between craft brewers and, you know, macro brewers, and as much competition and sort of distrust as there may be between those two cohorts, they ultimately, to your point, kind of, you know, they're pulling in the same direction ultimately as compared to cross category players like Vine Pair, or like like wine and and spirits. Not like Vine Pair. We're not pulling in any direction. We're rooting for everyone to win or lose. I don't know, depending on the day. But we're not rooting for anyone in the industry in particular. But you know, I think like Bart's point, which was well made, is this is not a simple answer of we just need to stop spirits from taking our share. There are bigger shifts at play, and you know, this is, you know, the pie is genuinely, at least in the short term, like going to be shrinking a little bit, and everyone needs to internalize that mentality, because what it means is more direct competition for what the industry likes to call share of sip, mm-hmm. You know, the overall spend of the American drinking public.
Yeah, I mean, related to that, you noted it in your piece that 600 breweries now also hold distilled spirits permits. And I thought that was really interesting, kind of related to this idea that, yes, the share of sip, how craft brewers have to kind of, or have been diversifying what they're offering to make sure that they can stay afloat, thrive, make money. So I don't know. I thought that was an interesting detail there, Dave. What do you think?
I think Bart was right to highlight it. And so this came up in the Tuesday general session. He was on stage for about an hour, kind of doing the download for all the attendees on a year's worth of data and surveys and analysis that he and his team have performed at the BA. This was a specific call out that he made. He said, quote, more than 600 active breweries now hold distilled spirits permits, close quote. They did that by cross-referencing like mailing address level, you know, information with the TTB to confirm that number is probably even a little bit higher, but that's what they were able to confirm. And his point was that there's growth to be had in more of that total beverage paradigm that we've seen bigger players already adopt. You know, I'm thinking of Boston Beer Company, which is now led, it's effectively Boston Twisted Tea Company, because yeah, Twisted right. Tea is its dominant brand family, you know. And Sam Adams is a shell of itself. I'm thinking about New Belgium, which is diversifying into hard teas, into hard hard juices, things of this nature, while they, you know, have the money printer going burr with Voodoo Ranger, right? Like there's models for this. And then of course, like the macros have long since caught wise to the idea that they need to basically play in every category. I mean, Molson Coors 5 years ago or so rebranded as Molson Coors Beverage Company, I think, rather than Brewing Company, to signal to their investors and internally that this was the game. You know, we're not just making beer anymore. Yeah. I think you're starting to see smaller independent brewers make that same realization or resign themselves to that same reality, depending on what their attitudes about it are. Bart said, quote, "We saw instead growth in wine and spirits." This is produced by craft breweries, wine and spirits produced by craft breweries. He said, "These are small numbers, but the percentage growth was pretty eye popping," close quote. So, you know, he's seeing not just the brewers go out and get those licenses to do spirits, which typically are going to take the form of canned cocktails right now, because that's a format that the drinkers, you know, are looking for, or produce, you know, wine to the extent that that makes sense for their business model. They're not only getting licensed to do that, they're actually going out and doing it and posting tremendous sales figures, you know, on a small base, but still nonetheless, like growth is growth right now.
Yeah.
I talked to a cider maker in Duluth, Minnesota, Wild State. One of their executives told me that the firm was moving into THC infused non-alcoholic seltzers, which Minnesota has a bustling market for, because they legalized the Minnesota legislature legalized the sale of these products a couple of years ago, I guess. It's hemp derived THC, and it's already a substantial part of his business. I mean, this is another thing that was talked about not too pie in the sky. You know, I mean, there's in states where it's possible, we're already seeing this, and I would expect to see more craft brewers, craft cider makers, people in this business looking at THC seltzers as opportunities to extend existing brands, or to create new sub-brand families, because drinkers are taking to this stuff right now. And is it a fad? Is it a trend? Is it here to stay? I think it's a little early to tell. I think, you know, that market is so nascent and sort of emergent, and there's so much regulatory uncertainty about whether or not, you know, states are going to allow it to continue in this way. But right now they're growing. That segment is growing, or that beverage is growing, and craft brewers are taking notice.
Yeah, I feel it seems to me that if they have the opportunity and they can do it, they should. Like, why not?
Yeah.
And you also included some of the remarks of Scott Metzger, the COO of Kraft Ohana, in your piece that I thought were really interesting. Just basically this idea that craft beer has been resting on its laurels and kind of riding the wave of its previous success. And it's craft beer got too easy and it stayed too easy right up until the point when it wasn't. That was a quote. And I think that that's just really interesting, kind of as it plays out with what you were seeing there, these other things that you were seeing there as well. And I know, Zach, you mentioned it earlier, but, you know, there was also this data from Bart Watson that he measured IPA slightly down in 2023. And I think for normal consumers, or, you know, even from my perspective, it seems like the IPA is where it's at, right? Like that is the hot style. And that's where we're seeing a lot of expansion and growth and like super saturation there. But it's interesting to see that that's not necessarily the case, and that it doesn't seem like it can be the most reliable style for brewers anymore.
The data that Bart shared on India Pale Ale as an overall segment, you know, or an overall style, that to me is the biggest alarm bell that I heard at this entire conference. I mean, for years, basically as long as I've been covering the business, which is 14 years, you know, it's as goes, IPA, so goes craft beer, right? Like this is the segment's fortunes have been so, so closely tied to the success, the continued success of the, you know, of India Pale Ale as a style. And of course, all the sub styles within that, right? I mean, we've just seen a tremendous proliferance of styles, of SKUs, of presentations in terms of, you know, size of package, right? Like 19.2s have recently become very hot over the past 5 years, but it used to be, you know, 22 ounce bombers, you know, big glass bottles or even larger format stuff. So we've seen it, you know, sort of take on new characteristics and grow and change with market.
And like succeed in every format.
Exactly. I mean, there's been very, very few, in fact, sort of notably few to the point that they're exceptions that prove the rule, flops within the IPA, you know, sort of umbrella, right? I mean, I'm thinking of like cold IPA or brute IPA, like that never really kind of had their moments or maybe had such brief moments and didn't really have uptake because consumers didn't understand them. Those are examples that stand in stark relief to the broader trend, which is, okay, we have IPA, now we have double IPA, now we have triple IPA, now we have hazy IPA, now we have hazy imperial IPA, right? Like now we have this package, now we have that package. Now we're going to mix them all together and, you know, get every section of the market with this mix pack that sells like hotcakes seasonally, right? So like it kept on working. And so for Bart to get on stage and say, hey, I'm, you know, individually, like if you look at sub styles, you still see tons of growth, you know, double IPAs, imperials, you know, hazies, whatever. But if you look at IPAs as a category, as a style, you know, and you look at all that together, it's slightly down. And he said, he used the term decaying. And I think, you know, that's a really good vivid image to think about what was the foundation for the contemporary craft brewing market, which is this broad, broad base of IPA sales. And it's like, well, there's just erosion there. There's just, you know, there's cracks in the foundation, so to speak. And that to me, like really rang out as like, I mean, Bart has a joke he's made many times before, you know, that IPA stands for immediate profits ahead, right? If your brewery's not doing good, make an IPA, your brewery's probably going to be doing good after that, right? Like it was such a sure thing for so long. This is a very bad time for that reliable foundation to be showing signs of fatigue.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting too, because I think part of the concern there is that the IPA sagging as a category might be less worrisome to craft beer if it was being replaced by something else. I mean, the early days of the craft beer industry were not built on IPAs. They were built on other stuff. And so it's not, no one is saying that the IPA is the final endpoint and has to be the perpetual bestseller in craft beer. But I think it is a problem when craft beer is shedding volume and it's shedding it from its most kind of reliable and popular and recognizable category. Yeah, I think there's a lot of reasons to be concerned. I want to ask you one more question, Dave, before we wrap things up here, I think. And that is, you know, you talked a lot about how, and we talked from the get-go about this sort of mix of optimism and enthusiasm still with, you know, kind of maybe some years of challenge, both obviously the early days of COVID presenting a certain set of challenges, and then just sort of the maybe more full realization that we are in at best, a kind of plateauing point for craft beer. What I'm wondering about is, what was your takeaway from the sense of groups that are excited about craft beer? Where is their particular enthusiasm, and who are there? Are we seeing an influx of drinkers, of producers that are, you know, could bring some vibrancy and sort of inject some life into the craft beer industry?
Yeah, it's a great question, right? Everyone's looking for, I mean, well, like we talked about earlier in the conversation, some people are not even worried. Some people, sure, there's just no doom and gloom. But, you know, the adults in the room, so to speak, the folks at the BA whose job it is to look at the aggregate industry-wide level are certainly seeing alarms that we've discussed over the course of this episode. And so that you're obviously the natural inclination is to look for bright spots and sort of hew to them, right? And see, okay, how can we turn this small, you know, green shoot into maybe a reed that's strong enough to kind of like hold this bridge moment of the business together. I think, you know, Joanna, you mentioned Scott Metzger's talk. Scott is the chief operating officer of Kraft Ohana and gave a terrific talk on day three that was titled something along the lines of like your brewery is a business, not a hobby, right? And sort of having, you know, is a tough love moment for the industry. But one of the points that he made was, you know, owners are going to make excuses and do make excuses for why their brewery is not doing as well as it could or should. And one of the points that he made was, you know, a brewer will say, well, you know, customers just like aren't, they don't like, you know, they don't understand my beer. And Scott's point was like, well, then you are not doing a good enough job either explaining your value proposition or you have chosen the wrong value proposition and you're trying to force it down their throats. That's not the customer's fault. That's your fault. And you need to take ownership of that because if you don't, you're gonna fail.
Right.
He had this terrific quote, you know, halfway through his presentation or so, he said, quote, they don't owe us anything, referring to customers, but we owe them our value proposition, close quote. And I thought that was a great take. And so, Zach, in the context of your question about where's their growth, where's their opportunity, it's the brewers that are rethinking their value propositions and rethinking who their core customer is now and needs to be in the future that we're seeing, you know, have some success right now or that are setting themselves up, you know, for success and for new growth in the future. And I'm thinking of two examples in particular that I encountered here at the Craft Brewers Conference this past week. One was a pretty illuminating conversation about regenerative agriculture using crops like Fonio, which is I believe a Western African
grain.
Cereal grain, yeah. And then Kernza, which is a grain that Patagonia, the apparel firm, has been pushing hard through its like food and foodstuffs division, and is partnering with brewers, both of which are way, way better for the environment than, you know, your traditional cereal grains. They have longer roots. They are less intense on the soil. They are actually carbon sinks. So growing a Fonio crop in the proper method is actually net negative carbon, which is just a crazy, you know, environmental profile. And Garrett Oliver from Brooklyn Brewery is very gung-ho on this. He's very much a believer that this is where the industry needs to go to be a leader, not just in terms of flavor and liquid innovation anymore, but in terms of environmental sustainability, like sort of harnessing the power of the economy or of capitalism to do this type of next generation, you know, beer brewing that's good for the planet and ideally good for the consumer. There's excitement there. I want to be very careful about like not getting co-opted into the excitement. I think it's really promising stuff. I remain very skeptical that there's a nation's worth of thirsty drinkers who are just waiting for the right sustainable beer to come along, you know, to take their premium, you know, spend, you know, shut up and take my money type of thing. I'm still not convinced on that. I mean,
me too. You know how I feel about this.
Totally. And like, look, I mean, feelings aside, like I did a column last year, McKinsey, you know, which is always looking to sell more things to more people, was unsparing in its assessment that in the beer and hard cider segments, sustainability claims on packaging at retail actually do worse than nothing at all. And, you know, Mary Guyver, who's the global buyer for Whole Foods, for the beer team at Whole Foods, you know, she's pretty, again, a pretty straight shooter. I've interviewed Mary before, extremely smart. And she sees the challenges a little bit more clearly because she's closer to telling those stories at retail, right? Like, yeah, man, like it's really cool and we should be doing it because it's good for the planet and yada, yada, yada. But like, let's be honest about the uphill battle that it's going to be to convince consumers that you should go out and buy beer because it's good for the environment. I mean, that's just not the way people typically make choices at retail. Even the diehard whole paycheck, quote unquote, shopper, you know, only is going to come with you so far on that journey. So that's a bright spot in a sense, but it comes with big caveats, right? Like, yes, maybe there's, you know, a sustainability story around beer that brings new drinkers to the category. I think there's some promising, you know, statistics and figures that panel shared about, you know, sort of the economic viability of these cereal grains compared to traditional cereal grains that brewers use. Mm. You know, so maybe there's savings there, incremental savings. I don't see it as a panacea. I am always trying to be careful not to be, you know, too jaded as someone who's covered this space. I don't think I would succeed at not being too jaded.
Well, you at least save that for fingers, mostly, yeah, right. In your memes in particular.
But I try to be. And so, you know, maybe there's a there. I'm not convinced, but I'm open to seeing how it plays out. I would not, if I were a brewer, I would be very skeptical, but I would be optimistic and willing to hear more about how this could change my business and bring new drinkers to the category. I think the more immediate opportunity, you know, for like bringing new drinkers to the category, glimmers of hope, was on display for me at basically the last thing I attended here at Vegas. I was like bleary eyed. I've been inhaling casino oxygen air for like the last whatever 12 hours for 3 days straight. And I stumbled into a back ballroom where the National Black Brewers Association was holding their press conference. It was 4 o'clock on Wednesday, the last day of the conference, basically the last event in the conference, but the room was packed. People were excited about it. And part of why they were excited, Zach, was because according to a pre-release or pre-conference press release that the NB2A had sent out, its constituents, its 85 Black-owned breweries across the country, have collectively posted about 20% annual growth for the past 2 years at a time when the industry is, the overall segment is basically flat to slightly down, and beer as a category is down, you know, five-ish percentage points. So there's growth happening in these niches. Sometimes the niche are styles, like beer styles, but sometimes the niche is a demographic. And I mean, this is a message that the Brewers Association, to its credit, I mean, has been trying to promulgate a little bit more explicitly over the course of the past five, 6 years, saying, hey, like, you know, if your business is slowing down, that's because you're making the same beer that everyone else is making. That's because you're targeting the same customer that everyone else yeah. is trying to target. But there is a vast group of a lot of times, you know, Black, brown folks who drink beer. They're these big beer drinking pop Asian communities. Although Asian communities drink more or less proportionate, if I remember the statistics correctly. But anyway, some demos under-index on the amount of beer they drink relative to the size of the drinking population, right? And if you can reach those people with real stories, with you know, fitting into their culture, fitting into their occasions, as the industry likes to say, in a way that's organic, in a way that feels real and not exploitative, you have an underserved demographic that will be loyal to you, and that will deliver, you know, the growth that you need at a time when a lot of people are kind of scraping, you know, to slice off an ever smaller slice of the white guy with beard pie, you know, right. of the consumer base. And I mean, you know, I'm encouraged by what I saw from the NB2A. I think, you know, the organization's only been around for a year, and they've made some big strides in that time to, you know, serve their members and to tell their story. I'm not convinced that this is a panacea either, nor should it be. I mean, you know, the Black craft beer drinker is going to be a portion of the market in the future, but it cannot be the main constituency. I mean, for that to be the case, Black drinkers would have to over-index on craft beer consumption compared to the overall population. But NB2A's executive director, Kevin Asato's point at the press conference was like, the drinkers are here. They want this beer. You know, right now, 88% of African-Americans drink spirits, but only 46% of them drink beer. He said, quote, there's no other demographic that has that significant of a gap, close quote. I mean, there's opportunity there is the point that they were making, and they view their constituents, their 85 member brewers, as key to cracking the code, capturing that you know, that demographic gap and closing that demographic gap, and where they go and how they, you know, how they do that, I think will be relevant to every brewer moving forward, because you know, diversity, equity, and inclusion are things that I think the BA has pushed very abstractly in the past, right? As these are good things for your business, these are good things for your taproom experience. But I think the more resonant, immediate lesson there is the economic imperative that I think a lot of brewers will hear. It's like, hey, man, like we're flat in sales, you know, across the board, but we're growing with the African American drinker, or we're growing with the Mexican American drinker. You know, you have to be realistic about, you know, who your customer is, and you have to go meet them where they are, as Scott Metzger, you know, argued in his speech. And I think there are opportunities still, even in this tough market for craft beer, to go do that.
Yeah. Very interesting, Dave. Please, if you haven't read Dave's Hop Take column, go check it out. And Dave, thank you so much for joining us. It's always great to have you and provide your insights and your, you know, experience. And
yeah, Dave, throw $10 on black for me. thanks so much. And Joanna, we'll be back with Adam on Thursday.
Sounds great.
Thanks so much for listening to the Vine Pair Podcast, the flagship podcast of the Vine Pair Podcast Network. If you love listening to this show, or even if you don't, but I really hope that you do, as much as we really do love making it, then please drop us a review or a rating wherever it is that you get your podcast, whether that be iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, anywhere. If you are listening to this on a device right now through an app, however you got this audio, please drop a review. It really helps everyone else discover the show. And now for some totally awesome credits. So, the Vine Pair Podcast is recorded in our New York City headquarters and in Seattle, Washington, in Zach Jabal's basement. It is recorded by Zach, mastered, and produced by Zach. He loves all the credit. Keep giving it to him. Drop his name in the reviews. He's going to love hearing how much you love him. It is also recorded in New York City by our tastings director, Keith Beavers, who is the managing director of the entire Vine Pair Podcast Network. I'd also love to give a shout out to our editor-in-chief, Joanna Sherino, who joins us on every single podcast as our third and most important host. Thank you as well to the entire Vine Pair staff and everyone who's been involved in making Vine Pair as special as it's become. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next week.